I'm very much struck by the extraordinary turnout for Dr. Chomsky and the amazing demand for tickets from the young people. I haven't seen anything like it, and I don't mean to disparage either of them by this, since the Pope's visit. And I don't expect Dr. Chomsky to say, young people of Ireland, I love you. But it's clear that the young people of Ireland love him. And would you welcome, please, Dr. Noam Chomsky.
Half a century ago, in July 1955, Bertrand Russell and Alfred Einstein issued an extraordinary appeal to the people of the world, asking them, quote, to set aside the strong feelings they have about many issues and consider yourselves only as members of a biological species which has had a remarkable history and whose disappearance none of us can desire. We face a choice, they said, that is stark and dreadful and inescapable. Shall we put an end to the human race, or shall mankind renounce war? Well, war has not been renounced, of course. Quite the contrary. The world's hegemonic power accords itself the right to wage war at will under a doctrine called anticipatory self-defense with unstated bounds. And it's backed in that stance by the spear carrier for Pax Americana, as Blair's Britain is described by a former NATO planner, Michael Maguire, in the Journal of Britain's Royal Institute of International Affairs, the pillion passenger of American policy, as the Institute describes Britain elsewhere. The Russell-Einstein warning is no less stark after half a century of denial. There have been efforts to strengthen the thin thread on which survival hangs. Now, the most important is the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, which came into force in 1970, in good part on Irish initiative. I recently learned 10 minutes ago. On the 50th anniversary of the appeal, of the Russell-Einstein appeal, the regular five-year review conference of the NPT, there is one every 5 years, it took place, that's last May in New York. A leading concern of participants and close observers was Washington's intent, I'm quoting, intent to remove the nuclear brakes, taking a big and dangerous step that will lead to the transformation of the nuclear bomb into a legitimate weapon for waging war. That's quoting one of Israel's leading military analysts, Reuven Pedatzur. That was a significant factor, in fact, the main factor, in the dismal failure of the review conference, which may, in fact, mean its end. I'll come back to these ominous developments, which were barely reported in the United States, don't know what happened here, and little appreciated among the general public. That thin thread on which survival hangs has almost snapped since the Russell-Einstein appeal, repeatedly, in fact. The best-known case is the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. The escape from nuclear oblivion seems miraculous. Two of the most prominent researchers recently concluded in a book about it. There was a retrospective conference in Havana in the year 2002, October 2002, and at that conference, the historian, well-known historian and Kennedy advisor, Arthur Schlesinger, described the missile crisis as the most dangerous moment in human history. Participants in the conference learned, to their amazement, that the dangers were even more severe than they had believed. They discovered at the conference that the world was literally one word away from the first use of a nuclear weapon since Nagasaki. The one word was that of a Russian submarine commander, Vasily Arkhipov, who should receive many Nobel Peace Prizes. He countermanded an order to fire nuclear-armed torpedoes when the Russian submarines were under attack by U.S. destroyers, and the commanders believed that a nuclear war was underway. Had he fired that nuclear-armed weapon, the consequences could have been dreadful, in fact, terminal. These revelations in October 2002 received very scant reporting, bare mention in the national press, and very little interest. That would have been remarkable at any time, but it was particularly so at that moment. That moment was described as the most dangerous time since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. It's Michael Crepin, who was the founder of the Strategic Studies Center in Washington, the Stimson Institute. The U.S. and Britain had at that time, as you know, just virtually announced their plans to invade Iraq, knowing full well that the attack would probably escalate terror and nuclear proliferation, as in fact it did. And it was also no secret at that time that a major contributory factor to the 1962 brush with disaster was a topic that was of great concern, a prime concern, right at the moment of the 2002 conference, namely international terrorism. In 1962, the Kennedy campaign to bring the terrors of the earth to Cuba was a factor in the major factor in the crisis. The phrase terrors of the earth is that of Arthur Schlesinger again, in his biography of Robert Kennedy, and according to Schlesinger, to bring the terrors of the earth to Cuba was Robert Kennedy's highest concern. He was in charge of the terrorist war, which was put on hold briefly during the missile crisis and resumed immediately after the crisis subsided. One of the high-level planners who attended the Havana retrospective was Kennedy's defense secretary, Robert McNamara, and he recalled that the world, in his words, came within a hair's breadth of nuclear disaster during the missile crisis. And he accompanied this reminder with a warning, namely a warning of what he called apocalypse soon. He described current U.S. nuclear weapons policy as immoral, illegal, militarily unnecessary, and dreadfully dangerous, creating unacceptable risks to other nations and to our own, both the risk of accidental or inadvertent nuclear launch, which is unacceptably high, and of nuclear attack by terrorists. He endorsed the judgment of Clinton's Secretary of Defense, William Perry, that his words again, there's a greater than 50% probability of a nuclear strike on U.S. targets within a decade. And those threats are being escalated, in fact, consciously escalated by the U.S. and Britain. The Iraq invasion is only the most glaring example. There's a consensus in the U.S. government's intelligence command that a dirty bomb attack, nuclear bomb attack, a dirty nuclear bomb attack is inevitable, in their words, and an attack with a devastating nuclear weapon is highly likely if fissionable materials, which are the essential ingredient, are not retrieved and secured, and their further production controlled. I'll come back to the critical question of controlling production, very much on the front pages today, but in the wrong context. There, which I'll get to, there had been some success in retrieving and securing fissionable materials since the early 1990s. That was under the initiatives of two U.S. senators, Sam Nunn and Richard Lugar. But these programs were put on the shelf by the new Bush administration. They were not interested in the programs to avert what the intelligence community called inevitable nuclear terror, just as they sidelined the so-called war on terror so that they could devote their energies to driving the country to war and then to efforts to contain somehow the catastrophe that they had created in Iraq. In the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is as respectable as you can get and not given to hyperbole, two prominent strategic analysts warned recently that the Bush administration military programs and its aggressive stance carry, in their words, an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. And they explain the reasons, which are straightforward. Pursuit of total security by one state, including the right to wage war at will and to release the nuclear brakes, that entails the insecurity of others who are likely to react. And they will make use of the terrifying technology that's now being developed in what Donald Rumsfeld calls the transformation of the military. And they point out that that technology will assuredly diffuse to the rest of the world. And in the context of competition and intimidation, there's an action-reaction cycle which creates, quote them, rising danger, potentially an unmanageable one. Hence, transformation, as currently being practiced, carries an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. Ultimate doom means terminal. Human species is over. Authors express the hope that the threat that the U.S. government is posing to its own population and to the world will be countered by a coalition of peace-loving states led by China. We've come to a pretty pass when thoughts like that are expressed right at the heart of the establishment. They bring up China for a good reason. It's because of all the nuclear states, it has maintained by far the most restrained pattern of military deployment. These are quotes all the way through. Furthermore, China has led the efforts at the United Nations to block the unilateral U.S. refusal to preserve space for peaceful purposes. That's since the Clinton years. The Clinton administration refused to join the call of the entire world, apart from Israel, in renewal and extension of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which does reserve space for peaceful purposes, and they immobilized the UN Disarmament Commission by barring outright any moves towards prevention of an arms race in outer space. Clinton's Space Command explained the reasons. They called for, quoting the Space Command, dominating the space dimension of military operations to protect U.S. interests and investment, much in the way that armies and navies had done so in earlier years, but now with a sole hegemon, no competition. The United States, which must develop space-based strike weapons, enabling the application of precision force from, to, and through space. U.S. intelligence and the Space Command during the Clinton years agreed, and their analysis is worth paying close attention to, they agreed that such measures will be necessary because globalization of the world economy will lead to a widening economic divide along with deepening economic stagnation, political instability, and cultural alienation, hence unrest and violence among the have-nots, much of it directed against the United States. So therefore, the United States must be ready for precision strike from space as a counter to the worldwide proliferation of weapons of mass destruction by unruly elements. That's a likely consequence of the recommended military programs, just as the widening divide and increasing unrest is the anticipated consequence of the specific version of international integration that's misleadingly called globalization or free trade and the doctrinal system. Well, the danger to everyone else is becoming even more serious as the Bush administration extended Clinton's doctrine. Clinton's doctrine was control of space for military purposes. The Bush administration extended it, I'm quoting, to ownership of space, which means instant engagement anywhere in the world. That puts the entire world at risk of instant destruction, thanks to sophisticated global surveillance and offensive weaponry in space. Bush's extension of the Clinton space doctrine was one implementation of the national security strategy announced in September 2002. The Space Command quotes are from shortly after. The national security strategy declared what was called a new imperial grand strategy. That's what it was called in a critical article immediately in the leading establishment journal, Foreign Affairs. Well, as would be expected, Russia reacted to Pentagon reports about militarization of space by announcing that it would consider using force if necessary to respond. Similarly, as had been anticipated, Russia had reacted to Bush's vast increase in offensive military capacity by sharply increasing its own capacities aimed at the United States. That's the action-reaction cycle, which everyone knows about. China was expected to follow what's called missile defense, which on all sides is understood to be a first strike weapon. That's a particularly severe danger to China. If the programs, there's a lot of talk about the programs not working, but that's missing the point. As long as they don't work, they're not a problem. If they show any sign of success, then we're in trouble, because China is likely to expand its offensive capacities to preserve its deterrent. In fact, that's a near certainty, which means more offensive missiles with multiple warheads aimed at the United States. That's the immediate consequence of any success in missile defense. In 2004, the United States accounted for 95% of total global military space expenditures, but others may join if they're compelled to do so. Both U.S. and Chinese analysts interpret all this in very similar terms. So U.S. analysts describe the programs currently under development by Washington as a significant move by the United States towards weaponization of space, and point out that space facing of weapons is very likely to have a negative effect on the national security of the United States. That's from the Naval War College Review. A Chinese analyst, now visiting Harvard as a visiting fellow, he writes that to China and to many other countries, the construction of these systems looks like the development of the Death Star spaceship in the Star Wars film series, which can be used to attack military and civilian satellites and targets anywhere, anywhere on Earth. The deployment of space weapons, which everyone understands to be first strike weapons, is likely to lead China and others to develop low-cost space weapons in reaction. So the U.S. policy, still quoting him, could trigger an arms race in space. Furthermore, he writes that to protect against the potential loss of its deterrent capability, China could also resort to building up its nuclear forces, which would set off a ripple effect. It would encourage, in fact, almost compel India to do the same. That would have an effect on Pakistan, then spreads without limit. Russia had already announced that it would do so, as I said. Others understand as well the same conclusions. So senior military and space officials of the European Union, Canada, China, and Russia recently published a statement objecting to these Bush administration plans, writing that the psychological impact of a blow from space might rival that of devastating attacks, such devastating attacks as Hiroshima, and just as the unleashing of nuclear weapons had unforeseen consequences, so too would the weaponization of space. Michael McGuire, former NATO planner, continues the article I was talking about with some very important information that's not well known. This is from the years when he was a NATO planner. Same writing in the British Journal of International Affairs, the Royal Institute Journal. He reminds us that in 1986, recognizing what he calls the dreadful logic of nuclear weapons, Mikhail Gorbachev called for their total elimination. But that proposal foundered on Reagan's militarization of space programs and called Star Wars informally. At the time, NATO doctrine was explicitly premised on the credible threat of first use of nuclear weapons, and that continues to be policy today. Russia kept to the same doctrine until 1994, when it reversed its stand and adopted a no-first-use policy and called for elimination of nuclear weapons. However, Russia reverted to the NATO doctrine and abandoned its call for abolition of nuclear weapons in response to a very important act of Clinton's, which is little known, namely the expansion of NATO to the east. That was violating a firm commitment by Washington, a categorical assurance, in fact, to Gorbachev, that if Gorbachev would agree to a rearmed Germany, reunited Germany, remaining totally in NATO, then the NATO alliance would not expand eastwards to absorb former members of the Warsaw Pact. That was the categorical assurance. Well, in the light of earlier history or just strategic truisms, Clinton's violation of these firm pledges posed a very serious security threat to Russia. That explains Clinton's violation of the pledge, explains why NATO also rejected Russian proposals for a nuclear weapons-free zone encompassing Central Europe from the Arctic to the Baltic Sea. That would have interfered with Clinton's plans to expand NATO to the east in violation of the firm commitment not to do so. All of that, obviously, enhanced the likelihood of apocalypse soon. But that has never been a high priority for planners, neither Clinton or Bush. Senator Nunn, who I mentioned before, a conservative senator, highly respected figure who's played a leading role in efforts to reduce the threat of nuclear war, he wrote recently in the British Financial Times that the chances for an accidental, mistaken, or unauthorized nuclear attack might be increasing as a result of policy choices that leave America's survival dependent on accuracy of Russia's warning systems and its command and control. We are running an unnecessary risk of an Armageddon of our own making, he wrote. What Nunn is referring to is the very sharp expansion of U.S. military programs, which tilt the strategic balance sharply in ways that essentially make Russia, quoting him, make Russia more likely to launch upon warning of an attack without waiting to see if the warning is accurate, because they'll have no choice. And that threat is enhanced by the fact that the Russian early warning system is in serious disrepair, along with the collapse of the Russian economy in the 1990s, and therefore more likely to give a false warning of incoming missiles. U.S. reliance on high alert, hair trigger, nuclear posture allows missiles to be launched within minutes, actually 3 minutes, forcing our leaders to decide almost instantly whether to launch nuclear weapons once they have a warning of attack, robbing them of the time they might need to gather data, exchange information, and generally assess the situation, gain some perspective, discover errors. We know that that's happened hundreds of times for the U.S. systems, and the anticipated Russian reaction to the Bush administration aggressive militarism increases the risk of an Armageddon of our own making, well beyond even that intolerable level. Now that's Senator Nunn, a very conservative and respected figure, I should say. There's a related concern, which was discussed in the technical literature well before 9/11, that is that nuclear weapons may sooner or later fall into the hands of terrorist groups. And those prospects are also being advanced by Bush administration planners and their British counterparts, who simply do not give terrorism a high priority, as they regularly demonstrate. Their aggressive militarism has not only led Russia to significantly expand its offensive capacities, and soon have the same effect on China, but it's also inducing the Russians to transfer nuclear weapons constantly across Russia's vast territory to counter mounting U.S. threats from every side. That's well known. Washington planners are also surely aware that Chechen rebels, who had already stolen radioactive materials from nuclear waste plants and power stations, but that they have also been casing the railway systems and special trains designed for shipping nuclear weapons across Russia. That's quoting Harvard University strategic analyst Graham Allison. Bruce Blair, former Minuteman officer, director of the Center for Defense Information in Washington, he estimates that every day many hundreds of Russian nuclear weapons are moving across the countryside. And theft of one nuclear bomb, he says, could spell eventual disaster for an American city. But this is not the worst-case scenario stemming from this nuclear gamesmanship. More ominously, he concludes, the seizure of a ready-to-fire strategic long-range nuclear missile or a group of missiles could be apocalyptic for entire nations. And all of this is imminent. Could happen tomorrow. Another major threat is that terrorist hackers might break into military communication networks and transmit launch orders for missiles armed with hundreds of nuclear weapons. And that's no fantasy. The Pentagon learned that a few years ago when serious defects were discovered in its own safeguards, which are much more advanced than those of the Russians, that required new instructions to be constructed for Trident submarine launch crews. Systems in other countries, particularly the recent proliferators, are much less reliable. All of that creates what Blair calls an accident waiting to happen, an accident that could be apocalyptic. These dangers are consciously being escalated, consciously, by the threat and use of violence, which, as long predicted, is stimulating nuclear proliferation, along with the jihadi terrorism that traces back to the Reagan administration programs to organize, train, and arm radical Islamists, not for the defense of Afghanistan, as proclaimed, but for the usual and ugly reasons of state, which had grave consequences for the tormented people of Afghanistan and also for Pakistanis and the world, as the Reagan administration cheerfully tolerated Pakistan's slide towards radical Islamist extremism under the rule of Zia-ul-Huq, who was one of the many brutal dictators supported by Washington and London in the 1980s. It's pretty much the present incumbents. Reagan and associates looked away politely while their ally was developing nuclear weapons. The Reagan administration annually endorsed the pretense that Pakistan was not doing so. The only threat remotely comparable to nuclear weapons is environmental catastrophe, also far too serious to ignore. As you know, there was a G8 summit meeting in Scotland last summer. Right before the meeting, the scientific academies of all G8 nations, that includes the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, they were also joined by the National Academies of China, India, and Brazil. They issued a statement calling on the leaders of the rich countries to take urgent action to head off this potential disaster. The London Financial Times endorsed what they called this clarion call, while deploring the fact that, reading their leader, there is, however, one holdout, and unfortunately it is to be found in the White House, where George W. Bush insists we still do not know enough about this literally world-changing phenomenon. Washington then succeeded in removing language calling for prompt action to control global warming and eliminating such inflammatory statements as "our world is warming." The reason they said is because Mr. Bush has said that global warming is too uncertain a matter to justify anything more than voluntary measures. And the end result, the editors continue, is that little remained in the G8 statement other than pious waffle. That all reveals again how the famous moral clarity of our leaders extends to the fate of their grandchildren. It's important to stress government here. There's a standard observation, which I'm sure you've read, that the United States stands almost alone in rejecting the Kyoto protocols. Now, that statement is correct if the phrase "United States" excludes its population. Population strongly favors the Kyoto Pact, overwhelming majority. In fact, support for it is so strong that over half of Bush's supporters believe that he supported it because it's so obvious. More generally, voters are seriously deluded about the positions of political parties. That's not because of lack of interest or mental incapacity, but it's because elections are carefully designed to yield that result. That also matters that bear quite directly on functioning democracy and indirectly on survival of the species. Well, McGuire writes further that under current policies, a nuclear exchange is ultimately inevitable. If present tendencies persist, we are virtually certain to see a return to nuclear arms racing involving intercontinental ballistic missiles and space-based assets, reactivating the danger of inadvertent nuclear war with a probability that will be extremely high. These, incidentally, are almost random samples from the general strategic analysis literature. As a step towards reducing the danger, McGuire urges Britain, his own country, to abandon its useless nuclear weapons, which he calls the lace curtains of our political poverty. But the crucial choices, everyone knows, are in Washington, or more properly, in the public arena, if the critical failures of contemporary Western democracy that can be overcome. Maguire's immediate concern in this article I've been quoting in the Royal Institute Journal, his immediate concern was the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the May 2005 five-year review conference. The Non-Proliferation Treaty was based on two, it was a bargain, it was based on two central agreements. Non-nuclear states would renounce the option of acquiring nuclear weapons, they were promised in return, first, unimpeded access to nuclear energy for non-military use, and second, progress on total nuclear disarmament by the nuclear weapons states. At the May 2005 conference, Washington's goal was to rescind both promises. That stand naturally reinforces what Maguire calls the cynical view that whatever the original intentions, the Non-Proliferation Treaty is now a convenient instrument of U.S. foreign policy. Washington's main demand, and that is on the front pages now, has to do with Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Washington wants it revised and restricted. And there's a good case that can be made for that. They're right, I agree with them. Article 4 grants non-nuclear states the right to produce fuel for reactors. Now, that made good sense in 1970. That's when the NPT came into force. But since then, there's been a lot of technological advance, with contemporary technology, fuel for reactors is just a bare step away from nuclear weapons. So it makes sense to modify and restrict Article 4. However, any such restriction of Article 4 has to include and guarantee the same unimpeded access for non-military use in accordance with the initial bargain. And there are proposals how to do that. A reasonable proposal was put forth by Mohammed El-Baradei, who's the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the 2005 Nobel Peace Laureate. His proposal several years ago is that all production and processing of weapons usable material be restricted exclusively to facilities under multinational control, accompanied above all by an assurance that legitimate would-be users would get their supplies for nuclear energy. And that, he says, should be the first step towards fully implementing a 1993 UN resolution calling for a fissile material cutoff treaty, informally called FISBAN, banning fissile material production, a treaty that would cap and make public all inventories of fissile materials still available, then leading on to the promised total disarmament. Well, El-Baradei's proposal was quite reasonable, and it would take a long step towards preserving the species, but it was regrettably dead in the water. The U.S. political leadership, surely in its current stance or any alternative on the horizon, would never agree to abrogate its unique exemption from international law and treaty obligations. So Washington's call for restricting Article 4 with regard to Iran is therefore regarded by most of the world quite rationally as just the cynical intention to convert the NPT into a convenient instrument of U.S. foreign policy. Now, U.S. specialists have proposed other proposals, advanced other proposals. Some of them are quite detailed. I'm not going to review them. But they all have one fundamental flaw. They require faith in Washington's benign intentions. And evidently, that's not going to go anywhere outside of Washington and 10 Downing Street. Maybe here, I don't know. Media coverage of the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference in May was very scanty in the United States. It kept very much to Washington's agenda. So as the conference opened, the New York Times reported that the conference was meant to offer hope of closing huge loopholes in the treaty, which the United States says Iran and North Korea have exploited to pursue nuclear weapons. That's referring to Article 4. So in brief, Washington's agenda, not shared by the world, nor shared by prominent strategic analysts. The news report on the opening sessions focused almost entirely on Washington's demand that Iran dismantle all the equipment and facilities, I'm quoting now, and the quotation's interesting, dismantle all the equipment and facilities it has built during the past two decades to manufacture nuclear material. Both American officials have said that they were concerned that as Iran's June elections draw nearer, a politically popular drive to restart the nuclear program may accelerate. Well, that's an interesting wording if you think about it. Notice first the casual recognition of the Bush administration's fear of democracy, hence the urgency to nullify expression of Iranian popular will. But more interesting than that is the interesting phrase, the past two decades. Why are they concerned about the past two decades? Well, the selected time span, since 1979, avoids an uncomfortable fact, namely that the policies that Washington now condemns are the very same policies that the U.S. supported before the 1979 overthrow of the Shah. That's the tyrant who was imposed by the United States and Britain in a military coup in 1953 that destroyed parliamentary democracy in Iran, overthrown in 1979. So today the standard claim is that Iran has no need for nuclear power, so it must be pursuing a secret weapons program. Quote Henry Kissinger, for an oil producer such as Iran, nuclear energy is a wasteful use of resources. That's Henry Kissinger today. When the Shah was in charge, and Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State, he declared that introduction of nuclear power will both provide for the growing needs of Iran's economy and free remaining oil reserves for export or conversion to petrochemicals. And the U.S. acted to accelerate those efforts, with Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, and others playing a significant role. U.S. universities were arranging to train Iranian nuclear engineers, doubtless with Washington's approval, probably with Washington's direct initiative. That included my own university, MIT, where the policies went through despite overwhelming student opposition, about 80%. Big crisis on campus. Well, asked about his reversal, Kissinger responded with his usual engaging frankness. He said, well, then they were an allied country, and therefore they had a genuine need for nuclear energy pre-1979, but now they have no such need because they're an enemy. Washington's charges about an Iranian nuclear program may for once be accurate. As many analysts have observed, it would be remarkable if they were not. It was predicted by strategic analysts that the U.S.-UK invasion of Iraq would increase not only terror, but also nuclear proliferation, as indeed happened, confirmed by intelligence agencies in both cases. Reviewing these conclusions, one of Israel's leading military historians, Martin von Krefeld, writes that after the invasion of Iraq, had the Iranians not tried to build nuclear weapons, they would be crazy. Washington has gone out of its way to instruct Iran on the need for a powerful deterrent, not only by invading Iraq, but also by strengthening the offensive forces of its Israeli client. which already has hundreds of nuclear weapons, and though a small country, it's offshoot of the United States, hence it has air and armored forces, which are larger and technologically more advanced than any NATO power outside the United States. Furthermore, to make the warning more stark, since early 2004, Israel has been receiving the largest shipment in its history of advanced U.S. jet bombers, very publicly advertised as capable of bombing Iran and equipped with unspecified special weaponry, as they're called, and deep penetration bombs, all of this intended for the ears of Iranian intelligence, who are to make the worst case analysis. There's another important European Union contribution. If you can only read one article about the current goings-on about Iran, I urge that you read the one that appeared in the London Financial Times yesterday morning by Zelig Harrison, who's one of the major specialists on this, who points out that he points out something which is true, but I don't think has ever been reported before, that at least, you know, in some public journal. He points out that there was an agreement, as you know, between the European Union and Iran a couple of years ago. It's now claimed that Iran is backing down from it. He actually quotes the agreement. The European Union made a bargain with Iran. The bargain was that Iran would stop its enrichment of fissile materials, and in return, the European Union develop and enforce proposals for security guarantees for Iran. It would deal with the strategic and security problems of Iran, and everybody knows what that means. It means the U.S.-Israeli threats to bomb Iran. But under U.S. pressure, the European Union backed off from that. Here's quoting the actual agreement. Iran's nuclear program, agreement would provide objective guarantees that Iran's nuclear program is exclusively for peaceful purposes and would equally provide firm commitments on security issues. Well, Europe backed down on that. The U.S. was opposed. It was unwilling to cooperate with the European Union in formulating concessions to Iran relating to security concerns, and that has the obvious consequence that Iran has no reason to take the agreement seriously. Well, that's European cowardice in this case. What it shows is that, again, it's just no way of looking at it except as a cynical intention to advance U.S. foreign policy, Europe agreeing. Iran has options. It may abandon any hope that Europe could follow an independent and honorable path, just too subservient to the United States, and it may turn to the East, which is perfectly possible. China is one country that can't be intimidated. That's why the United States is so frightened of China. It's not like Europe. Europe backs down when there are any pressures. China doesn't, continues. In fact, Chinese trade relations with Iran are increasing while Europe, under U.S. pressure, is backing off, receiving oil from Iran. China is also increasing its relations, extending its relations with Saudi Arabia, both military and trade. The U.S. would love to block it, but it can't intimidate China. Iran might decide to join the Asian energy security grid, based primarily on China and Russia, but with India and Japan and South Korea probably joining, which is an effort to form an independent system for securing energy resources for the fastest growing economic region in the world. If Iran joins it, it becomes sort of its linchpin. Iran is being pressed in that direction, may very well move in that direction. There are developments in Iraq which are also proceeding in directions very threatening to U.S. power interests. There's a lot of talk these days about withdrawal and exit strategies, but most of it is pretty meaningless, and it will remain so unless we're able to escape the rigid doctrinal constraints that require right-thinking people to reject with horror what everybody in the world takes for granted outside the West, that the U.S. And Britain invaded Iraq because of its enormous energy resources and to gain even greater control over the energy resources of the Middle East, which back as far as 1945, the State Department described as a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. It was also recognized back in the 40s that control over these resources would give Washington veto power over the rest of the industrial world. It was George Kennan, one of the major planners in the late 40s. And that point has recently been reiterated by one of the more astute of contemporary planners, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Wasn't particularly in favor of the invasion of Iraq, but he pointed out that if the U.S. can maintain control over Iraq, it will gain critical leverage over its European and Asian rivals. Well, the U.S. and Britain will surely do everything they can to ensure that Iraq becomes a reliable client state, much like the U.S. dependencies in Central America or Russia's East European satellites, or for that matter, traditional colonies of the imperial powers. They are typically run by domestic collaborators, domestic security forces, sometimes even with what are called elections, but with the iron fist of the master visibly clenched and ready for use when needed. It's called sovereignty and independence by the masters. Surely what the U.S. and Britain are going to try to achieve in the case of Iraq. You can almost hardly doubt that. And the reason is that it's very clear. If Iraq gains any measure of sovereignty and moderate democracy, its Shiite majority will be dominant. The major oil reserves are in the Shiite regions, and they're enormous. They do have close relations with Iran. They go way back. Many of the very influential clerics, the majority of them, either come from Iran, as Ayatollah Sistani does, or have close relations with Iran. The major militia, which is mostly running the south, the Badr Brigades, was trained in Iran, took part with Iran in the Iran-Iraq War. The relations have since been closer, even with limited sovereignty. The U.S. can just look on and not do much about it. Any limited degree even of Iraqi sovereignty is likely to strengthen the efforts of Shiite forces across the border in Saudi Arabia. The regions right near Iraq and Saudi Arabia are mainly Shiite. They've been bitterly oppressed by the U.S.-backed fundamentalist tyranny and have been seeking a degree of rights, maybe autonomy, that's only going to increase. It already is increasing. And that happens to be where Saudi oil is, most of it. So you can see the prospect that's driving people berserk in Washington and London, undoubtedly. There's a prospect that the major source of world energy hydrocarbon resources will be in the hands of a loose Shiite alliance, including Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Shiite Iraq, Shiite Iran, probably with closer links to China already developing, and out of the control of Washington and London. I mean, that would be a nightmare for Washington and London, almost the ultimate nightmare. And unless these considerations are brought to the forefront, talk about exit and withdrawal strategies and also opposition to occupation don't really mean very much. You've got to escape from the iron grip of doctrine even to talk about these things. Well, since I've lost all my places, I'll have to search for a second. Here we are. Partly the reason is there's no light up here. There's a primary reason why the Non-Proliferation Treaty has collapsed or is facing collapse, and that is the failure of the nuclear states to live up to their own obligations. That's Article 6 of the treaty, which requires the nuclear states, one part of the bargain, to undertake good faith efforts to eliminate nuclear weapons completely. That commitment was underscored by a 1996 World Court decision that they are legally obligated, I'm quoting, to bring to a conclusion negotiations leading to nuclear disarmament in all of its aspects under strict and effective international control. And as long as they refuse, it's unlikely that the bargain will be sustained. NPT will disappear, have a rash of other nuclear states. El-Baradei merely reiterates the obvious when he emphasizes that reluctance by one party to fulfill its obligations will breed reluctance in others. All the nuclear states are guilty in this respect, but the U.S. is far in the lead. It's led the pack in its refusal to abide by Article 6 obligations. And for the first time under Bush, it's officially renounced them. It's said that it is no longer bound by Article 6. It's rescinded the unanimous agreement at the year 2000 review conference for an unequivocal undertaking by the nuclear weapon states to accomplish the total elimination of their nuclear arsenals. At the 2005 conference in May, went further. The rejection of the obligation was explicit and clear. At the close of the conference, the U.S. spokesperson went so far as to say that, quoting him, the treaty requires reduction but not elimination of weapons. It's a transparent falsehood, and it wasn't lost on others. Another central part of the NPT compact was the commitment of the nuclear powers to enact and implement a series of other treaties. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was rejected by the Republican Senate in 1999 and was declared off the agenda by Bush. The ABM Treaty, which Bush rescinded. And most important of all is a verifiable FISBAN, Fissile Materials Cutoff Treaty. That's the most important. That would prevent further addition of nuclear bomb material to the already vast amount already existing. In July 2004, Washington announced its firm opposition to any verifiable FISBAN. Nevertheless, in November of 2004, the United Nations took up the issue and had what I think is the most important vote in its history, maybe to the extent that we have future history in any history. In November 2004, the UN did vote in favor of a verifiable FISBAN. The vote was 147-1 with two abstentions. Israel, which is reflexive, they must vote with the United States, and Britain. The British ambassador explained his refusal to vote with the overwhelming majority, namely everybody, in favor of FISBAN. He said that Britain is in favor of it, but this particular version, he said, has divided the international community. Namely, it divided it 147-1. So therefore, the spear carrier couldn't go along. And that actually gives a lot of insight into the ranking of survival of the species among the priorities of the leadership of the hegemonic power and the pillion passenger, and of the media. There was no, in the United States, there was no coverage of this. I have not found any in Europe. You can tell me if there was any here. As that continues, for the rest of us, that means we march along, following our leaders to an Armageddon of our own making, if we choose to do so. There's nothing inevitable about the choice, and it's a choice that has very grim consequences. Thank you.